Welcome one and all to the Track One Side One podcast. I'm your host Gaz Jones, and this week's guest is the host of the Ruth is Stranger Than Fiction podcast, Ruth McPhee. As you'll see, it's a wonderful chat with five great tunes put upon the mixtape. We discuss why Shakespeare's Sister are ripe for rediscovery, and also I get way too overexcited talking about Meatloaf. I mean, who wouldn't, right? So please enjoy. And I'll speak to you as ever at the end. Cheers.
I feel kind of basic today. Top five side ones. Track ones.
You're listening to the Track One Side One podcast with me, your host, Gaz Jones. The greatest. Each week, a guest picks their five favorite album opening tracks, and we dissect, discuss, and debate each one. So let's put on our classics and have a little chat then, shall we?
And we are live. Joining me as my guest this week, staring at me through my laptop screen via the medium of Skype and that interweb ting, is Ruth McPhee. How are you?
Hello, guys. I'm really good, thank you. Very happy to be here.
Before we crack on with your list, mate, I was wondering how hard was it getting it down to just five songs?
It was difficult. It wasn't that I had, 30 different choices. It was that I had about 10 and I was trying to get those down, and they were 10 songs that I really loved. And it was getting it from that already quite short list down to the five. So it was, I really struggled. And there were some that kind of, I had it going over in the back of my mind. You know, they would come in and out. So I started off with a few and then I was like, okay, no, they go away. Oh, they come back later on, get back on the list again. And so it was kind of a little rolling series of, I would say, about 10 songs or so that right. Eventually settled into the last five. I mean, as I think I said to you, I said I was struggling to choose, and it does seem initially you're like, OK, fine, that'll be like a nice, fun thing to do. Yeah. And then the more you think about it, you're like, oh, it's so important. I have to get exactly the right choices.
All right. Without further ado, what's your first choice? What do you want to talk about?
So I want to start with it's a bit of a sentimental choice, which I will explain shortly. I want to start with the song Goodbye, Cruel World by Shakespeare's Sister. And that's from the album Hormonally Yours, which I believe came out in 1992. So I would have been 10 when that came out. So that was one of the very earliest cassette albums that I remember buying. And I'm sure that I had, someone had probably bought me like a Kylie album or whatever before that. But I remember going into HMV in the Grafton Centre and buying that album. Probably someone's going to write in and go, actually, the HMV in the Grafton Centre didn't open until blah, blah, blah. But in my mind, that is the memory I have. and I remember buying that. I mean, I'm sure like everybody else that bought that album, because of the great success of the hit Stay, which I think for a lot of people was sort of their introduction to Shakespeare's Sister. And actually getting the album home and being like, Stay is the worst song on this album. Everything else is like absolutely amazing, and Stay is only quite good. And just loving that first track, Goodbye Cruel World. And I love Siobhan Fahey, and I sort of later in life have grown to love her even more, because I've kind of realized a lot of the political elements to her work that sort of passed me by when I was 10, you know.
Yeah,
then later you think actually that, the sorts of things that she was writing about in Shakespeare's Sister and when she was in Bananarama were, quite feminist issues and quite brave things to be writing about for pop. I love the kind of contrast of their voices.
Yeah, completely.
It's fantastic. And her, just the raspy vocals of Siobhan. I just remember hearing for the first time when I, listening to that track, just being like, oh, this is so good.
There was no one that sounded like them. They kind of stuck out a mile, really. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you. I remember when their first album came out, I remember the first big hit they had was Your History.
I remember that being
kind of everywhere the summer of 1990. This album, Hormonally Yours, it was kind of one of those albums that everyone had at school. It kind of seemed to unite a lot of tribes. And I love the kind of massive Cocteau Twins vibe, especially on this song. And the way their vocals, like you said, the way their vocals blended, it was just kind of absolutely incredible. Like infectious alt pop, emotionally rich, quirky, very quirky. Mm-hmm. And they seem to use the medium of video to their advantage. You know.
Absolutely, yeah. Which again, I mean, maybe there were other people doing that, but the kind of cinematic elements to their videos and the almost the kind of fantastical elements that they had in some of the videos sort of really stood out at the time.
I think this was like their last album until, because they split not long after this, I think. And I think they reformed a few years ago.
Oh, yes, probably. One of my later favourite Siobhan Fahey things is there's an amazing live video of her singing White Rabbit.
Oh, really?
Which I'm not sure when it was recorded, but I came across it on YouTube at some point and I just was like, this is perfect. This is, you know, perfect vocals, perfect song for Siobhan Fahey.
What are the characteristics that make a great opening track? Ooh. What do you look for?
Well, I was thinking about this when I was making my choices, because I was thinking, is it something that prepares you for what's to come almost? So do you want it to be representative of the album that's going to follow in some way, that it's so it kind of lays the groundwork for you? And I think you do want a bit of that. I think you want a kind of bombastic opening that's going to say, OK, here's some of the elements of what I'm going to get. And then as you go through the album, it will pick up on some of those things that you have brought out in the first track. I think that's what I like. And that's what, when I was looking at my choices, that's what I was kind of thinking about, is representative in itself, like a brilliant song, but also that ties in well with what comes afterwards in the album.
Track two, where are we going?
Okay, let's say they're all going to be a bit of a change of tack from the one before.
No, definitely. It's a wonderful little mixtape.
Yeah. So let's go in a completely different direction, and let's go for Stink Fist by Tool, one of my all-time favourite bands. And I wonder, Gaz, if you would like to say the album name, because I never know how you say it.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to do that. You robbed one of my questions. I mean, you know, this album has been part of my life for about 25 years, and I still really don't know.
I think Anima would be safe if we went for that. And I think just what I was saying just now about that idea of it, like, it prepares you. I mean, actually, Stink Fist prepares you in the way that it basically pommels you over the head so that you're prepared for the later pummelings that the album is going to bring. So it's not a gentle preparation for the rest of the album, but it definitely, it goes in as it means to continue, I would say.
The opening to this song. This was the first Tool song I ever heard. I remember seeing the video on MTV. Obviously, you know, all the Tool videos were directed by Adam Jones from the band. There was all, you know, the incredible kind of stop motion, Giga-influenced animation. Like what we were saying about Shakespeare's Sister, their videos kind of stuck out a mile, especially, you know, what you think MTV would have been playing in 1996 when this came out. You know, it was still very much Blur, Oasis, Foo Fighters, stuff like that.
A bit of Green Day, maybe.
Definitely a bit of Green Day.
But quite upbeat.
Obviously, MTV couldn't say this is the new Tool song called Stink Fist. If a VJ introduced a song, it was named as track number one.
Oh, perfect. So, yes. It's as if they knew.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's not about, as far as I can tell, I mean, breaking down Maynard James Keenan's lyrics is like, I don't know, trying to find your way through a labyrinth, shrouded just metaphors upon metaphors. But I don't think it's about extreme sexual acts. You know,
no, although when I was saying just then about it pummeling you over the head, I was like, maybe that's the wrong metaphor to use, given the title of this song.
I think you could be right.
But no, it's such a powerful song. And I think actually I was thinking about when I first heard this, and I think it would have been probably the first Tool song that I heard. And I think I would have heard it probably quite a few years later, because I think the first time I heard it was at a club in Brighton. There's a club we used to always go to called the Pavilion Tavern, and Wednesday night was like metal night at the Pavilion Tavern. So when I was at university in Brighton around kind of 2000, I remember they would have, you know how they always do at clubs, so they're like, oh, we have like the kind of jolly metal bit comes first, then they would do a bit of inevitably new metal because of the time it was, and then they were like, okay, now we're doing like the metal fans metal. Yeah. And I always remember that hearing it there in this kind of dark nightclub surrounded by sweaty long-haired men and just being like, oh, I'm alive. This is amazing. And just, yeah, such a kind of powerful, like, pounding, thumping rhythm to it. Mm. And the vocals amazing as well. The voice is just otherworldly almost. It's incredible.
Have you ever seen Tool live?
I saw them live at, I think it was at the Big Day Out at Milton Keynes one year. Yeah, incredible. One thing I think about Tool live is they're like perfect to the album. So they're tight and there's so no chance that any of them are having an off day. No. It's always, you know, just incredible. Mm. Tiny shorts, of course, tiny leather shorts.
Of course, of course. Of course. I can't imagine Maynard wearing anything but.
And I also have a lovely memory from the Pavilion Tavern Metal Night, Wednesday nights, which was my friend Lucy, who I used to always go with from university. One night we grew impatient. They hadn't yet played any Tool. Mm. Usually they played Stinkfist. Sometimes they would play Eulogy, which is track two on that incredible album. And Lucy was like, right, they had a big blackboard where you could go and write your requests.
Oh, nice.
On what you wanted them to play. And she just got the chalk, and on the whole huge size of the blackboard, she just wrote in massive letters, Tool!
Did it work?
It did work. They were like, fine, we know. Yeah. We know it's time for Tool.
What's your favourite Tool album before we move on? If you can only
It is Anima,
one.
Yeah.
Anima, okay.
Yeah. I like the new ones, and I really like Lateralus.
Yeah, that's my
A
one.
Lot.
Yeah.
And I nearly went for The Grudge, track one on Lateralus, but in the end. But yeah, it always comes back for me to Anima. Hmm.
Is the importance of an opening track of an album, as we first knew it, when we were starting to obsess over music, when we were in, you know, younger teenage years, whatever, do you think that importance of an opening track is something that's been lost in the digital age?
What a good question. I think yes, because I think that you can pick and choose so much more now. Because if you, you know, say you've heard a single by an act that you like, you could just go, right, I'm going to look up that single on Spotify and I'll just listen to that single. Or Spotify will have arranged a playlist for you.
Always.
But it's going to be, you know, here's the top five tracks from this artist that you're now interested in. Yeah. But it's to actually go, right, ignore that, ignore these best of suggestions. I'm just going to go to the albums and listen through in their totality. Yeah, I think that has been lost. And I was talking to my partner about it. He has had to hear, oh, what about this one? Oh, should I do this one? About my choices all the last 3 weeks. Oh, I'm taking this off and I'm putting this in. And he's like, yes, fine. But we were...
Chris, I'm really sorry, Chris.
I think he's been secretly making his own list, so I'll quiz him.
Nice.
We were talking about even the financial investment that you make as a 14-year-old or whatever.
Totally.
To go out and say, so you buy an album, it's cost you, what, 12 quid, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. And you've bought that. And if you listen to it once and it doesn't really, and you're like, oh, it's not what I was expecting. Mm. You've bloody paid that money. You're going to listen to that album 20 more times until you like it. Yeah. Whereas I think now that sense of kind of having to invest financially and emotionally is lost a little bit. So I think, yeah, it must be a very different experience. I mean, do you still listen? Do you still sort of sit down, put an album on and listen to it all the way through? Or do you do more of the kind of chop and change of the digital age?
You know, for me, it's still a real treat to get a record out, put it on the turntable, drop the needle and listen to the whole thing. I still get an incredible kind of thrill out of that. I mean, what is your format of choice? Do you still, have you got a record deck or do you Spotify or?
I'm still on the CDs. Chris is a vinyl man, so he will usually put a record on, but I've still got all my old CDs.
Nice.
So I'll usually just go back to the CDs.
I think CDs in maybe another 5 to 10 years time, that'll be like the hipster's format of choice. That'll be the next one that gets that. Kind of
comes back round on the wheel.
Completely. Yeah, completely. And you know, all of a sudden people will be paying like, I don't know, £30-40 for a mint copy of Shine 6. I'm a big believer in it. Track 3, where are we going?
Okay, again, a change, quite a change. This is probably not as well known as the other songs that I've chosen. This is a song called Everything Goes Around the Water by the Delgados from an album called Peloton, which, again, I think it's mid-90s. And they are a Scottish band, and they're actually probably best known, as it were. They are the band that started the Chemical Underground record label.
Oh, okay, I didn't know
which
that.
Is, you know, bands like Mogwai and I think Arab Strap, but, you know, that have had a kind of higher profile on that record label. But they are, yeah, this kind of like an indie, you know, a bit of a classic indie band in a sense. It's just, this is one of the ones that when you said, come and do this show, it was one of the first ones that came into my mind. And then I kind of thought about lots of other things and I put it on the back burner because I thought, well, it's not very, you know, compared to something like Stinkfist, compared to some of my other choices, it's kind of a low key, I guess. So it went away for a bit. And then I kept thinking, oh, I love it, though. I do love it. There's something kind of sort of magical about it. And so it came back in and it's forming a kind of quiet centre to my other my other choices surrounding it.
I haven't listened to the Delgados in, I don't know, best part of 20 years. It was quite a joy rediscovering this album again.
Yeah, it's hard to describe exactly why. It's an album I have listened to sort of steadily, I would say, in that over that 20-year period. And there's loads of albums from the time by probably bands that are not dissimilar that I have not picked up again, or that, you know, I put on once and then sort of forgotten about. And there's just something about it that I keep coming back to. And I think for Everything Goes Around the Water, one of the things, again, that I love, as with the Shakespeare Sister song, is it's got a kind of interplay of two voices. And I really like the way that, and it's a male and female voice, that interplay between them works. And I think that is what makes the song so special.
When Emma Pollock's voice comes in and they start intertwining after about a minute and a half of the song. Oh, I'd totally forgotten that. It's been so long since I've listened to this band. And I love all those Belle and Sebastian, Wilco, Pavement kind of slacker vibe.
Yeah.
That they have a bit of Elliot Smith as well, but yeah, the whole kind of boy girl vocal intertwined is just, it's just instant swoon.
And I think that the dynamics of it are quite interesting because it starts very quietly and it sort of builds and it builds and it builds this momentum. And it, you know, it doesn't reach kind of Mogwai levels of Sonic Insanity, but it, you know, it in itself, in its own kind of quiet way, it really plays with dynamics. And in fact, I was complaining about the way that a lot of modern songs, modern pop, I don't think you get a dynamic change. I find they're very kind of one tone. And it's a huge generalisation, of course, and I'm sure there's so much modern music that I have no idea about, but it doesn't seem to go anywhere. I'm like, oh, you started at this point, you've carried on at that point, and then it's finished.
The problem with a lot of kind of modern music and pop music especially, it's not a song, it's product. And it's all about that instant hit that those Spotify plays. This is why, you know, 9 times out of 10, the chorus will be in like the first 10, 15 seconds of the song. Otherwise, people are just skipping. There's no kind of room for, I don't know, dynamics or even taking you on a journey. If people haven't got their fix in the first 20, 30 seconds, they're going to skip it. And that doesn't even class as a play. They won't get there, I don't know, whatever it is, an eighth of a pence or something.
Oh, God.
You know.
Yeah, actually, that is exactly right. And I think that's what is so brilliant about Everything Goes Around the Water. It has that, it pays off. If you are willing to, like, put a tiny bit of patience in and you to kind of go along with it as it builds. And then you do get that payoff and you do get that dynamic change and that kind of wonderful feeling of almost kind of resolution, I think.
I mean, where did you first hear the Delgados?
That is a good question. And I don't know the answer.
I'll put you on the spot. I'm really sorry.
I'm sure Mogwai must have had something to do with it. I got into them at the time that I had a boyfriend when I was a teenager, the lovely Matt Fletcher. And he was a like super huge enormous Mogwai fan. And I think we must have just sort of gone, oh, let's see what else is on this record label. And I really kind of took to the Delgados and really loved the Delgados. And their first album, Domestique, is also brilliant. And then the third album is called somewhat It seems a bit shocking. It's called Hate. And I remember when Hate came out and I was like, wow, they've taken a turn.
Yeah.
But the musical style is actually quite similar. It's just got this very sort of bold name. And I think that must have been how they sort of wiggled their way into my consciousness. Mm. So it isn't that same sort of pow effect as with something like Stinkfist, where you hear it and you're just blown away by it. I think it was a kind of gradual, in the same way that I think the song kind of reveals itself to you. I think it was that sort of a quiet, but not quite insidious, because that sounds sinister, but a sort of, you know, a gradual process of acclimatisation to being a massive Delgados fan.
Do you still enjoy listening to an album from start to finish?
I do, and actually, as I'm sure everyone has over the last year or so, I've had a lot more time on my hands to actually do that again, and it's definitely something that I've got back into almost, to be able to have a bit of time to really listen from start to finish rather than just popping in and out of things. And definitely it's been a really lovely thing to be able to have the time to do.
Is it something that you like to treat yourself to? I mean, I know you said you've obviously got back into it more over the past year. Was it a nice habit to go back into again?
It sounds awful to say it. I had to almost train myself to do it again. And then, so it was that first thing where you're like, you choose an album and put it on and think, oh, I love this album, I'm going to listen to it all the way through. And then after about three tracks, you're getting a bit like, oh, should I just, itchy fingers, should I skip on? Should I put something else on? And actually to train yourself to have that attention span, to really listen all the way through and appreciate it. It's absolutely worthwhile to do that again.
Okay, track four.
Okay,
where are we going?
Now, for the last two tracks, I feel I am veering slightly into self-parody for the people who know me. Both of these last two tracks are two of my absolute favourite songs in the history of music. I cannot leave them out. So number four is The Mercy Seat by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, from Tender Prey, a rare foray into the 80s for me. One of my favourite ever songs. I listen to it incredibly regularly, I don't often listen to Tender Prey, but I listen to The Mercy Seat a lot. And I just think it's again, it's so powerful. And I think to put that as track one on an album, you have to really believe in the rest of the material for that album, because I think to me, it's almost a closer.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. Yeah. It's kind of the thing that you build up to
for
the rest of an album. And to go in with that, track one, wow, I think you're really, it's confident.
That says a lot about Nick Cave, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I mean, I can't remember when I first heard this. It's just every time I hear it, it inspires such an emotional reaction. And wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, if I hear The Mercy Seat, I have the same kind of almost visceral response to it. I just adore it.
What we were talking about earlier about, investing kind of time and energy into an artist.
Mm.
Nick Cave was always one of those names that was bandied about when I was younger. Like, you've got to listen to Nick Cave, man. Oh, my God. the birthday party and the Bad Seed stuff. It's like, oh, my God. And I remember hearing, I think it was the duet with Kylie. That was the first time I became aware of Nick Cave. Went back to listen to, I think I got the greatest hits. And I'm not going to lie, I didn't get it. I was just like, oh, it's that kind of like wall of guitar noise, which makes the vocals virtually inaudible. It's almost like you have to read the lyrics to go alongside it to try and work out what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, and I haven't said that much about lyrics today, but I think I'm a very morbid person and I have the classic morbid person's obsession with serial killers. And I think the fact that The Mercy Seat is about Henry Lee Lucas, serial killer, or and the electric chair and that kind of thing, that obviously really appealed to me as a teenager and continues to appeal to me today as I approach my 40th birthday. So I think you're right, you can't hear the lyrics, but I remember doing exactly what you said. Like, I remember listening to it and reading through the lyrics, being like, I love everything about it. I'm so dark and morbid.
And the way the lyrics kind of like, they're like laden with allusions to Christianity.
Yeah.
And the mercy seat is also like, the symbol of God's throne.
Yes.
Over the Ark of the Covenant.
He's wonderful in the sense that if you get into Nick Cave later in your life, the back catalogue is just incredible. So it's by the time I started listening to the Bad Seeds, they'd already, probably released 10 albums or whatever.
Yeah.
So to discover a band that you love that much and then to be like, there is so much to listen to, this is just amazing, is such a wonderful feeling. And to be able to go back through that back catalogue, and it's such a kind of a rich seam of dark music and complex music and disturbing imagery, and as you say, that all that kind of religious allusion that is in there as well, it's just such a wonderfully kind of deep river to kind of fling yourself into.
Before we go on to your last track, I want to quickly say that obviously we can't play the songs during the podcast because of the glorious copyright police. But what I do a Spotify and YouTube playlist that will go out with each episode, so people can listen along to your choices and you know, remind themselves just how fucking awesome Shakespeare's sister were.
Yes, absolutely.
Please do. In terms of a wonderful choice, let's go full in on the last song. Oh, okay. My God, I'm so excited about this.
So we've gone full Ruth McPhee self-parody down the wormhole now. But the last choice has to be Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf from the album Bat Out of Hell. One of the absolute most incredible songs ever written, in my opinion. And Jim Steinman, of course, the amazing orchestration and the lyrics and the song, and then the vocals of Meatloaf himself. Never to be bettered, I would say. No. My love of Meatloaf is often derided by all around me. I stand firm in my love for Meatloaf, and especially for Bat Out of Hell, which is just an insane operatic kind of marathon of a journey. I love it.
It's a marathon journey of a song, never mind the album.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's unbelievable. It's like, by the time this song finishes, you know, after like 10 minutes or whatever, I'm fucking exhausted.
It's emotionally draining.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. and then it's like you've got to pick yourself up straight away because it just kicks into On a Hot Summer Night.
Yes.
Would you offer your throat? It's like, oh my God.
Yes, all of them are bangers on that album.
Oh, it's just one of those songs where it's just like every like 30 seconds it goes up another 10 notches and then another 10 notches.
Yeah, you think it's not possible, but it's possible.
Yeah. And you think the song's going to end. It's like, no. And then, you know, the roar of the motorbike, which was done on guitar, I'll have you know.
Incredible.
One take. Todd Rundgren did one take of the rum, rum, rum. On guitar, and then that final note that he hits, that high C, which I've read stories that apparently he passed out while hitting that note, to the lyrics, you know, the torn and twisted at the foot of a burning bike. Hearing this album when I was a kid, it was just like, it was like the ultimate comic book set to music.
I got into Meatloaf because my mum is a huge Meatloaf fan. So that's, you know, we would often have in the car would be a Meatloaf tape that kind of went in the cassette player as we drove along. And I had a friend at primary school called Catherine, and her dad was a huge Meatloaf fan. And I remember us in the playground at primary school, like just caterwauling at the top of our voices, all the words to Bat Out of Hell, to the horror of classmates and teachers alike. So we would like roam the playground just singing the full length of Bat Out of Hell with all the different parts and really dark lyrics.
Totally. I mean, it's kind of like a teenage tragedy in the mold of like songs like Leader of the Pack.
Yes.
The way it ends is just kind of brutal, but yet poetically beautiful.
Yeah, kind of a romantic feeling remains. That almost that sense of you feel so strongly when you're a teenager in that idea of kind of true love, and then that idea that, you know, if one of you dies, it always remains this sort of perfect idea of what love was, which again, something like Leader of the Pack has as well. And of course, by now we're old and jaded, so we're like, how? Yeah. What a foolish notion. But that whenever you hear listening to something like Bat Out of Hell, you get transported into that kind of, you know, every tiny permutation of a relationship is like so dramatic, and it's all it's life or death. Everything is either amazing or terrible. It's just that kind of absolute roller coaster of emotions that I think you get with most Meatloaf songs, to be honest, but especially
Oh my God, yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's just one of those songs that it kind of transcends everything. Era, genre, styles, taste, fashion.
Yeah.
And for Meatloaf, for me, kind of my generation got into Meatloaf when Bat Out of Hell 2 came out.
Right.
You know, still in my lifetime, probably the biggest comeback
yeah,
I will ever see.
I'd do anything for love.
Yeah, man. You know, number one for 9 weeks or something. Yeah. I still love that song. You know, Bat Out of Hell was fucking preposterous as it was, coming out in 76, 77. Mm. Every record label in America passed on it.
Yeah.
You know, like, no, this is ridiculous. It won't sell. No one will listen to this crap.
I mean, they were right that it is ridiculous. But
it's crazy.
Best possible way.
Yeah, of course, you know. This is, you know, when Spinal Tap say this goes to 11, this song goes to 11 and a half.
25.
Yeah, no, completely. I remember when I Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That came out, and it was just so ridiculous. Coming out after, you know, Nirvana and all this kind of, all the whole grunge movement had killed your hair metal, your Def Leppers and your Bon Jovis, all this kind of stuff, Poison and Warrant and all these bands. And then, but yet Meatloaf ends up having the biggest selling album of 1993.
Yeah.
With Hell 2. And it just shows, you know, his audience was waiting for it.
Yes. And I think it really appeals to, yeah, that idea of being a bit out of time, and the idea that he's being kind of untouched by trends. Or, yeah, you know, I don't care what everyone else is doing. We're going to plow our own furrow with this ludicrous operatic rock that, you know, we've been doing for years and years.
Either you're on board or you're not.
Yeah, and if you're not, fuck you.
I don't know, there's something so timeless about it, because it was always kind of out of time, I guess.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I'm so pleased you're so enthusiastic about Meatloaf.
Oh, my God.
What a delight to end on such an enthusiastic response.
I know. It's like when you sent your list through, I was like, oh, Shakespeare's list at all, yeah, Wicked with Delgado's cool. Oh, my God. Ruth, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been a delight.
Amazing stuff. Cheers, Ruth. And be sure to check out her awesome historical horror podcast called Ruth is Stranger Than Fiction. It's an absolutely cracking listen. And I hope you all enjoyed this episode. And maybe you've discovered your new musical obsession. So please take care of each other out there. And I'll see you all on the flip side. Adios.
I'm feeling kind of basic today. Top 5 side ones. Track ones.
You've been listening to the Track One Side One podcast with me, Gaz Jones. Give us a follow on all the social medias at Track One Side One podcast to keep fully up to date with all future episodes and guests, where there will also be links to Spotify playlists that will accompany each show. So please check them out. And I'll see you soon.